Hi, Lynn Malcolm here. It's all in the mind. So let's be mindful of this breath and this breath.
Mindfulness is something of a paradigm shift. It's asking people to stop, slow down, entertain the idea of a different mode, a mode of being, the mode of being more responsive rather than reactive, choosing to step out of automatic pilot on a regular basis.
Willem Kuyken, director of the Oxford Mindfulness Centre.
Mindfulness is really, it's a very ancient practice. It's got its roots in 2,500 years old through the Buddhist contemplative practices. But it's really about training our attention to be more present. And through that, we develop more awareness about what's going on from moment to moment, both within ourselves, so emotionally and in our thought processes, but also relationally. So in the world, when we're interacting with others, you know, if we're feeling emotionally triggered, we're picking up on that data much more quickly, and we're much more able to respond with more wisdom and more effectiveness.
Elise Bayou, doctor in psychiatry and founder of Mindful in May. Mindfulness is everywhere. Interest in it seems to have grown exponentially. Have you tried it yet? Today we take stock to look at the latest science on how being mindful changes the brain, its potential for treating depression, and even how it's entered the consciousness of Googlers in Silicon Valley. Elise Bayou was exposed to meditation practice as a child, but came to it later, finding it helpful with her stress levels. Then her attention was drawn to the scientific research showing mindfulness could positively affect the brain, the body, and well-being. She was so inspired to share her interest that she began Mindful in May.
So Mindful in May is a one-month global online meditation campaign that aims to teach people who have never meditated before how to meditate and how to develop the skills of mindfulness, but it also aims to raise awareness about a global issue, which is the global water crisis, and give people a way to come together to make a real difference.
This year's Mindful in May challenge has just begun. The idea is that you register online, and each day you receive by email the audio of a 10-minute guided meditation, along with other related information. You commit to a daily practice and you ask for sponsorship from your friends online to raise money for a World Water Project. Elise Bayou suggests that there's a philosophical connection between raising money for charity and mindfulness.
I think that fundamentally within the teaching of mindfulness is a sense of developing compassion, both for ourselves, so developing a sense of self-compassion as we come into contact with different struggles that we might have, different emotional struggles, but also it helps us to develop a sense of interconnectedness with other people. And so I think naturally, as you become more aware of what's going on in the world and you feel more connected, both to yourself and to other people, other humans that you might know or not know, there's just this natural flow on that makes you actually care. And then from that care, there's a natural flow on that creates a sense of wanting to actually take action, take responsibility. So I do think there is a relationship there, and I think it's quite a strong one. And I think that for so many of us, life is so busy that we not only don't we have time to actually connect with ourselves on a daily basis to check in, know what's going on so that we can respond more effectively rather than wait till we fall into a heap in some sort of stressful crisis to get help. So we have trouble connecting with ourselves on a daily basis, but also, you know, I think we're so busy we sort of forget that we're active citizens in this world and it's our responsibility to come together and create the world that we want to see. So it's training attention. So we have to choose an object where we're going to place our attention. So often we start off with the body and we start off with simply just noticing sensations in the body, because the body is an anchor to this present moment, whereas our minds are not reliably here. They're often in the past or the future. So we start with the body. Then we move to the breath, which is a little bit more difficult to to feel for many people. And really, the breath is used because, again, it's always with us. So it's an anchor point. We can always bring our attention here. And then inevitably we notice that the mind is going to wander off into thoughts, planning, organizing. And the real practice, the real heart and soul of the practice, is noticing when the mind wanders off, letting go of wherever it's gone and bringing your attention back to where you want it to be. And the best analogy for this that's popularly used is around physical exercise. So this is like a form of mental exercise. It's a discipline and it's simple, but it's not easy. But it does, as you continue it, just like physical fitness, you do notice the benefits of this in a capacity to be more focused, more present and more aware of what's going on from moment to moment.
So you deliver 10-minute guided meditations. Is 10 minutes a day long enough? How did you come to that duration?
A lot of the research that's been done, particularly around mindfulness-based stress reduction, was based on sort of 25 to 40 minutes a day of meditation. I'd trained and taught in this program. But what I believe is that, particularly for people that are newer to mindfulness, it's much more effective to introduce them to a smaller bite-sized taste that then leaves them feeling inspired. They still feel the benefits and they're more inclined to actually keep going, rather than starting off with, I need to meditate 40 minutes a day, and then feel like a failure because you haven't been able to do that. And it ends up feeling quite burdensome and something that's on your to-do list. Now, I actually also was very curious about this question of, you know, can 10 minutes really have a benefit? I know from anecdotally from the thousands of people that do Mindful MA each year, I get lots of emails every year saying, I can't believe how much this has helped me and it's only been 10 minutes a day for a month. But actually this year we're going to try and answer that question through research. So I've actually organised research that's being done, which is really exciting, specifically on Mindful MA and this 10 minute a day, to see what the relationship is between Mindful MA and our well-being through the 10 minutes. So I'd probably be better able to answer your question next year.
Dr. Elise Bailloux says the response to Mindful in May over the past 3 years has been inspiring, and they've raised over $300,000, bringing clean water to thousands of people around the world. Many mindfulness practitioners report real benefits for their health and well-being. But what does the latest scientific research show? Professor Sara Lazar is a research scientist at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. For the past 15 years, she studied the neural mechanisms of yoga and meditation. I'm speaking with her on Skype.
Initially, we studied the effects on long-term meditators versus controls, and we showed that the brains of long-term meditators are different than the brains of matched control subjects, and that they had more cortex in certain brain regions compared to the controls. The one huge caveat of that research is that we can't say conclusively that the differences were due to meditation practice. It could be other lifestyle effects. So, for instance, many people who meditate are also vegetarian. Or it could just be that people with this different type of cortex were more likely to start meditating in the first place. So some of our more recent research then looked at people who had never meditated before. We scanned them. We put them through an 8-week meditation program, and then we scanned them again. And we showed that there's growth in certain brain regions as a result of this meditation practice. And again, we compared it to a control group that just got scanned 8 weeks apart, and there was nothing in between. And so now we know that, yes, when you learn meditation, your brain does actually grow and change. And now our newest research is trying to focus in on some of those brain regions that change and try to understand a little bit more about what's going on there. So we really are honing in closer and closer.
In Sara Lazar's recent research, the course participants went through a program called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. It was developed in 1979 by Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. MBSR is now one of the most well-respected secular mindfulness programs. The techniques taught include a formal sitting meditation, observing the breath, a body scan, and a slow, gentle, mindful yoga exercise. These are designed to develop skills in attention to what you experience in your body at any moment, without judgment. So how do these practices actually change your brain?
So basically, learning anything new is going to change the structure of your brain. What we thought was interesting was, well, A, that it actually did it, because a lot of people say, oh, meditation, you're just lying there, you're not doing anything. So by showing that it changed the brain, it really does show that just like, you know, learning a new language or learning any new task changes your brain, meditation changes it in the same way. It really shows that it's a very active learning process. And then what was interesting is also where we found some of the changes. So for instance, one of the primary regions we found to change was a region called the posterior cingulate cortex. So it's about halfway back behind your ears, and it's right in the middle of your brain. This is the number one region that goes in Alzheimer's disease. And it's a very important part of the brain. It's found to be involved in a lot of different processes. In particular, its main thing seems to be about sort of mind wandering and staying in the present moment and sort of related to memory. And you know, this is an area that seems to be improved by this. And that's another region we found to be different was the hippocampus, which again is also very important for aging and Alzheimer's and memory. And those two work together. And so this data is suggestive that it could potentially help slow down or prevent those sorts of diseases.
So because you've seen actual changes in brain scans, can you necessarily conclude that that translates into different feeling and behavior and outlook on life?
Right. So that's a little harder to prove. What we did in that first study is we gave them questionnaires, and the change in some of the other brain regions correlated with these changes in these questionnaires. In particular, we gave them a stress questionnaire, like the standard question about stress. And we found that another brain region called the amygdala is well known to be involved in stress and anxiety and fear. And it's known that, for instance, if you take animals and you put them through some sort of stress regimen, the amygdala gets bigger. And what we found is that the amygdala got smaller and that the change in the amygdala correlated with the change in stress, right? And this is self-reported stress. So these people, nothing in their life was changing. You know, everything was still stressful in their life, but their relationship to the stress changed. And that's what correlated with the change in the amygdala. So it really does suggest that there is this neural reason why they're feeling less stress. Another part of the brain that is involved in producing a lot of the molecules that are important for anxiety and depression and whatnot and positive mood as well, that also changed as a result of meditation. And change in that region was correlated with changes in well-being. So people saying that they felt more in control of their life and, you know, that they were not exactly happier, but just more satisfaction with life. And so, again, these are consistent. They're not proof, but they're consistent with these self-reported changes.
And do you know anything about the length of time that you need to practice mindfulness for the effect to show itself?
Yeah, I always get that question. We don't have a good answer for that yet. There's been a little bit of research suggesting that even 5 or 10 minutes a day can provide some benefit. And so at this point, what I like to tell people, just doing even 5, 10, 15 minutes a day, 3 or 4 times a week, you're probably going to get some benefit. And if you can do more, that's great. Though, generally speaking, we recommend practicing no more than 45 minutes a day. And that's basically what in the East, what they recommend is just 45 minutes a day.
And what would the problem be with practicing for more than 45 minutes a day?
There is a very, very, very slight chance of mental injury, you could say, for meditation. I mean, it's very, very rare. And usually you have to practice for like, you know, hours and hours and hours per day.
What sort of injury? I'm just interested to know what you mean.
Obviously, some people have psychotic breaks, which is where they sort of lose their sense of who they are. But it tends to be people who have a family history of mental illness, or people who have traumatic experience, or again, people who practice for like hours and hours and hours on end, seem to be the people who are primarily at risk for this.
Professor Sara Lazar from Harvard Medical School. Sara Lazar says the next step for her mindfulness research is to look at the effects of mindfulness over the long term. You're listening to All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia and online. I'm Lynn Malcolm. And today we're exploring the buzz around mindfulness. Now it's also beginning to be used as an adjunct in the treatment of some mental illnesses. Willem Kuyken is Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Oxford and Director of the Oxford Mindfulness Centre. This centre is at the forefront of scientific research into mindfulness. It also trains mindfulness teachers. Willem Kuyken is researching the efficacy of mindfulness as a therapy for depression. He joins me on Skype.
Yeah, the evidence for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for recurrent depression, I think, is probably, it's fair to say, is now very strong. There have been at least 10 randomized trials, and as you know, that is considered the gold standard in the evidence world, suggesting that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy does better than usual care. It really helps people with a history of recurrent depression stay well in the long term. In a recent paper of ours here in Oxford, just published in The Lancet last week, we were able to demonstrate that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy may actually also provide an alternative way for people to stay well to antidepressants. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy as a way of teaching people with a long history of depression skills to stay well, I'd say the evidence base in that area is very strong.
And it compares favorably so far to antidepressants?
It appears to be an alternative. It certainly doesn't do better than antidepressants, but antidepressants do pretty well in keeping people well in the long term. Although, if one were to take a balanced view, you could argue, if one was inclined to have a glass half full perspective, you'd say, great, we've got antidepressants, they help people stay well. We've now also got mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, that also helps people stay well. If one were inclined to take a glass half empty view, we'd say we got two treatments that both are okay, but could probably do a lot better. And that's part of our work in Oxford, to try and develop and enhance treatments to do better than what we've currently got. Mm. I'd say the evidence in relation to other mental health problems is very promising and is developing very rapidly, but is not as strong.
Details of the Lancet article Willem Kuyken mentioned are on the All in the Mind website. So how is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy different from the stress reduction approach?
It's a really interesting question, really good question. I think the way mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is different from MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, is that it uses a sort of theoretical formulation. It has an idea about what is it that tips people with a history of depression into another episode of depression. And then it takes that understanding and really tries to support people in learning the skills at those precise moments, those exact moments when somebody tips into a depressive relapse. Ah, there's that very negative thinking. There's that very ruminative, proliferative thinking. And it enables people to recognize that, step back from that, and respond in a different way. So just to give you an example, I had a woman in my class a couple of years ago who was the mother of a toddler. And she was pushing the toddler on a swing in a playground. And this was a really happy moment because he was chortling away with glee and with happiness. And she felt a sort of a moment of happiness. And in that moment, this little negative thought came into her mind. I don't deserve this happiness. This happiness isn't going to last. And just on the back of those two fragments of thoughts came a whole cycle, a whole cascade of negative thinking along the lines of, I'm no good as a mother, my son's going to get messed up by me, oh no, and so on. And this is the moment that depressive relapse can happen. And what mindfulness enables people to do is to see those moments, not get snagged up in them, not get caught up in them, step back from them and respond in a different, more skillful way. So in her case, she coined a phrase, which is, aha, that's my wrecking ball thought. It's a wonderful metaphor, because of course, with a wrecking ball, one can sort of take a step back and see this very powerful ball just pass through awareness without necessarily being knocked sideways by it, without necessarily engaging with it. So what mindfulness-based cognitive therapy does is absolutely teach mindfulness and meditation skills to enable people to train their attentional muscle, to train their awareness, to be able to see patterns of mind, patterns of thinking, and learn the skills to step back from them. The analogy that's often used is if, you know, we wanted to become physically fit, we would need to go out running, we'd need to go to the gym, we'd need to do repeated exercise. The same is true with training the mind. To train the mind out of very ingrained and old habits, as is often the case with recurrent depression, takes effort, takes time, takes repetition. And I think that's the rationale for asking people to, over the 2 months of the mindfulness classes, to really go to the gym, if you like, every day and practice the mindfulness practices.
And how long do they have to sit?
Well, we invite people, we ask people to sit for 40 minutes a day throughout those 2 months. So that's what we suggest people do. That's not to say that it's always easy, but it's illuminating, it's interesting, and I think it creates possibilities that certainly people with recurrent depression go, aha, I've tried that. That's not worked so well. This does seem to provide the possibility of something that might work for me.
And what's known about the sustainability of the effect? Does somebody have to keep doing it for the rest of their lives?
You know, as a scientist, I have to answer that by saying I'm not sure we really know the answer to that question. As somebody who's practiced mindfulness myself for 20 plus years and worked clinically with a lot of people over the years, my sense is that people need to engage in some ongoing practice to keep those skills alive, to keep that learning alive, to keep that sense of interest alive. But I think we don't yet know what exact recipe, if you like, of ongoing practice will sustain benefits for people.
Do you think that there's any danger in mindfulness being overstated or overhyped at the moment?
I think that's absolutely a danger. And I think what is really important is there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm around mindfulness and there's a lot of interest in mindfulness. I think that's for a whole range of different reasons. And that's great. But I think there's also a responsibility for those of us who work in the sort of science community to A, generate knowledge that can answer key questions, like how much practice is needed to keep people well over the long term, but also to report the evidence responsibly. So to not overstate the evidence where the evidence doesn't yet exist, or not claim evidence that doesn't exist in an area yet. So I think there's both a responsibility to generate new knowledge, but also to report the knowledge that we have responsibly.
And Willem Kuyken, director of the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, also has a strong practice himself.
Mindfulness provided for me a real awareness, a real insight into habits of mind, an understanding of how I had the potential both to experience suffering, but also great joy, great compassion, great kind of intimacy in my relationships. And so through 20 years of sitting pretty well every year, a retreat of a week or so, and as best I can, having a mindfulness practice every day, I've really been able to, I would say, kind of retrain my mind, retrain my behavior in ways that I think has benefited me enormously.
Mindfulness is even starting to penetrate the corporate world. Van Riper is in the well-being learning team at Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. And for the past few years, he's led a team of Googlers in the Mindful in May online campaign, and they're ready to go again. I'm speaking to Van Riper via Skype about how mindfulness first became part of the Google culture.
It actually originally was started out with Chade-Meng Tan. He was one of the early employees of Google, and he is the person who was having some difficulties in his own life and turned to meditation to help himself. And after helping himself, he decided he wanted to make this available to others inside of Google. And he's the person who founded the Search Inside Yourself program, working with experts in the field like Jon Kabat-Zinn and Daniel Goleman. So a big part of these programs is the benefits in terms of emotional intelligence, your ability to have better relationships with other people that comes from this practice. And those things directly relate to better work relationships, resulting in a better result for Google.
So Chade-Meng Tan, does he still have that wonderful title of Head of Mindfulness?
I don't know if that's his current title. He's the Jolly Good Fellow.
That's what he's become known as.
He is a Jolly Good Fellow. I mean, he's been a great inspiration to all of us that are working on these programs. His goal to achieve world peace through bringing these mindfulness practices to the world.
Van Riper from Google is also the global manager for a program called GPAWS. It supports communities of mindful practice at Google offices around the world.
We've had educational programs and training programs for a long time at Google, but there hasn't been a lot of follow-up in terms of support for practice. And this is what the GPAWS program is there to do. It's kind of like providing the space and also the community support, the buddies, your meditation or mindfulness practice buddies. And we're also doing more than just meditation. We're also supporting mindful meetings, mindful lunches, different things like that. For example, I was just here in the Milan office. It's a small office. There's only like 120 people, but they have group sits there on Tuesday afternoons from 1:30 to 2 and on Friday mornings from 9:30 to 10. And that's open to everyone at the Google office in Milan. And I was just here giving an introduction to mindfulness class. We had about 20 Googlers sign up for that. That's one of the things we do. In some of the larger offices, we also do some other practices like mindful lunches.
So that's eating your lunch mindfully in silence.
Yes. Yeah. You get some instruction at the beginning. The chefs at our cafes that support this put together a really nice vegan meal, typically, for this. And oftentimes we'll even make it part of the experience, like they try to use the locally sourced foods and actually tell people where the foods came from and how they were prepared. Then the bulk of the meal is in silence, and then there'll usually be a time for reflection and sharing at the end of that.
So what are some of the qualities that the Google is hoping to foster and encourage by giving people the opportunity to go through mindfulness programs?
We found that these practices can help to manage stress, and we take on a lot. We have big goals and objectives at Google, and that can be stressful. Just personally, it helps to make people happier. And also, it does boost productivity. And we've actually done internal studies of groups of teams and offices where people have been practicing regularly. And there's some results there that we're going to be sharing publicly soon, that the people that do practice regularly do get these benefits.
I noticed that Chade Meng Tan, who was the head of mindfulness, says that Google is likely to play a major part in mainstreaming mindfulness. What do you think he means by that?
Well, we're hoping to share best practices and also studies about the benefits that we're achieving at Google in the hopes that other companies will, and other companies already are, but even more companies will get into this in a big way.
Van Riper from the Wellbeing Learning Team at Google's headquarters and leader of Google's Mindful in May team for this year. Whilst Mindful in May founder Elise Baillieu is passionate about her campaign, does she think there's a danger that mindfulness is overhyped?
It certainly is everywhere, and it has become a bit of a buzzword. And I think, you know, there's already a backlash around that. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because I think that when things become popular, they risk losing their depth. And so I think that, yeah, that might be the risk of it being overhyped, that people are spouting things about mindfulness and they actually are not coming from a place of deep practice and perhaps even embodiment. They're not actually doing the practices, they're just writing about them and talking about them. So I think it's about having a balanced, informed view of what's going on.
So how do you see the future of Mindful in May?
Well, I have a big vision for Mindful in May. By 2020, we hope to teach 1 million people the skills of mindfulness through this program and raise $20 million to bring clean water to over 600,000 people in the developing world. But mindfulness has taught me to just take each step breath by breath. So I'm just working hard and spreading the word, and we'll see what happens.
Dr. Elise Baillieu, founder of Mindful in May. And if you're very quick, you can still sign up for this campaign. Go to the All in the Mind website, abc.net.au/rn, and choose All in the Mind in the list. And there you'll find a link to Mindful in May and other references to the show today. And do let us know your experiences with mindfulness by leaving a comment on the site, or you can share your thoughts on the All in the Mind Facebook page. And if you haven't already, sign up for the All in the Mind podcast. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Joe Wallace. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Being mindful till next week at the same time. See you then.